Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a single magnificent document from the early medieval world, a piece of 9th century art and political theater, and we're just going to break down its incredible complexity.
It's a fascinating one.
This is the famous puzzle portrait of Louis the Pious.
Mm-hmm.
And our mission, really, is to go beyond just looking at the image and decode this deep theological and political message that's embedded right inside of it.
Right, because this isn't just a royal portrait. It's so much more. You're looking at a brilliant example of early medieval visual propaganda.
And it comes from a specific tradition, right? The Harley Psalter, the Utrecht school style.
That's the one. And what makes this piece so unique, and you know why scholars just call it a puzzle, is this concept of carmina figurata.
Which means?
It's poetry, where the actual arrangement of the letters, the text itself, forms a recognizable image. So we aren't looking at ink just filling a space.
No.
We are looking at a continuous Latin poem that has been meticulously, painstakingly arranged to create the emperor's body.
The genius of that is just, it's hard to wrap your head around.
Oh, it is. The scribes who devised this were, they were masters of connecting the intellectual rigor of literacy, of theology, directly to the tangible power of ruling.
I find the sheer architectural discipline of it staggering. You have a full body picture of Louis the Pious, his head, his torso, his limbs, and it's all formed letter by letter from a poem.
And we know this isn't random filler. Every single character is intentional.
It's all part of a continuous praise poem.
Exactly. But the sheer brilliance, I think, lies in the layering, what we call the cipher layout trick.
Okay.
If you, the listener, look at this image, you see the emperor, and he's framed by this dense grid of script. The scribes, they essentially built a three-dimensional message into a two-dimensional space.
So how does that trick actually work? Because it sounds like they didn't just write one poem, but several, all at the same time, using the same characters.
They did. That's exactly what they did. The primary message is in that Latin praise poem running horizontally across the whole image, filling out the space of Louis's body. Right.
But wait, there's more. If you isolate the vertical column of letters that runs right down the exact center of the emperor, kind of the spine of the text, that forms a completely independent poem. It has its own meaning. And for the keenest readers, they placed secondary acrostics in specific regions, often around the limbs.
So the first letter of each line spells out yet another secret phrase or word.
You got it.
That level of multi-textual encoding is, it's a masterwork of political engineering. It means the reader had to be incredibly sophisticated, almost decoding the image as they were reading it.
And that sophistication was the message. This complexity wasn't an accident. It was a deliberate, powerful statement. The layout was designed to show that order, symmetry, and meaning radiate outward from the emperor.
So the difficulty, the perfect synchronization of the image and the three layers of text.
It all served as this profound Carolingian theological assertion. It showed that Louis wasn't just in command of the physical realm, but also of the sacred word itself. He had intellectual and spiritual control over the whole universe he governed. That concept that order radiates from him is the perfect segue into the content of the text. So if the architecture proves he rules by order, what specific rhetoric did the scribes use? What were they broadcasting in those poems?
Well, the poem is a complex blend of panegyric, that high-flown praise, and this very deeply articulated imperial theology. It was all aimed at securing Louis' sometimes precarious position.
And scholars have pulled out some core messages from the critical editions of the text.
Yes, there are about four that consistently come up.
Give us the first one.
Okay, so the foundational message is that Louis is not simply a king. He is an emperor who is divinely guided. His rule isn't an accident. It's not purely inherited. It is sanctioned by God. That elevates his status way beyond his predecessors.
And the second point connects him to, the highest possible historical precedent for a Christian ruler.
Precisely. To lend weight to that divine mandate, the poem explicitly connects Louis to the tradition of Constantine the Great. By doing that, the scribes didn't just establish him as the heir to his father, Charlemagne. They established him as an heir to the grand tradition of Christian kingship, the very foundation of the Roman Christian Empire. It implies a restoration, a continuation of sacred history.
Okay, so the third message then shifts from that historical lineage to military doctrine, but with a theological twist. The Miles Christi.
The soldier of Christ, yes. This is maybe the most politically charged point in the Carolingian world. The poem clearly depicts Louis as the Miles Christie.
And what did that designation really do?
It subtly but radically shifts the focus from relying just on, say, Frankish military prowess to engaging in divinely sanctioned holy warfare. His battles aren't just for land anymore.
They're for the faith.
They're for the faith. And this provided an ideological defense against external enemies, you know, the Vikings, the Magyars, but also against internal aristocratic dissent. It's hard to challenge a war effort when its leader is literally the soldier of Christ.
And the fourth message sort of grounds all of that divine and military authority in the day-to-day function of a ruler. Justice and protection.
Yes, exactly. It emphasizes his piety, his devotion to justice, and his role as the shield of the realm. So taken together, it's a full-spectrum justification for his reign. Divinely chosen, historically linked, spiritually armored, and practically effective.
And we see that captured beautifully in one of the representative translations. Parts of the poem read, "He rules by the power of the Supreme King, the defender of the faith, who conquers through piety and restores the order of the world."
Conquers through piety. I mean, that phrase right there, it just encapsulates the entire political and theological shift we're talking about.
How so?
Well, earlier Carolingian legitimacy was heavily weighted toward conquest and ancestry. This poem, created by the intellectual elite who served Louis, argues that his legitimacy is fundamentally tied to Christ's authority as the true source of power. Ancestry is secondary. Theology is paramount.
Which was crucial for Louis, who inherited this massive, complex, potentially fracturing empire.
He needed a source of unity beyond just military might.
And here's where the visual language kicks in to really reinforce the text. If the poem gives us the doctrine, the image provides the proof. Let's look at the iconography, the little visual notes that back up the text's claims.
Yes, and these visual elements are not mere decoration. They are theological arguments in shorthand. Look first at the halo. It frames him as a Christ-chosen ruler marked by divine favor. It's an incredibly powerful tool of visual authority.
But there's a crucial theological precision here that the scribes were very careful about. He is chosen, but he is explicitly not a saint. Why was that distinction so important in the 9th century?
That distinction was absolutely critical. It upheld the very delicate balance of power between the emperor and the church, specifically the papacy. Designating an emperor as a saint would imply he possessed a unique, self-derived spiritual authority. That could blur the line between secular and spiritual governance, and it would undermine the pope's unique role. So, by giving him the halo, but not the formal title of sainthood, the image confirms Louis is divinely selected, but still accountable to the spiritual order of the church.
It's the highest honor without overstepping.
Exactly.
Okay, now let's look at his equipment. His weapons seem to be a visual summary of that whole Miles Christie message.
Absolutely. He holds a shield, the classic symbol of defense, but also a spear that is prominently formed into a cross at the tip.
That's pretty unambiguous.
It's an immediate fusion of martial and liturgical authority. He isn't fighting for Frankish glory. He is fighting with the authority of the crucifixion itself. Every battle is a defense of the faith.
And even his clothing speaks to a historical archetype, helping to shift a viewer's perspective.
The dress code is deliberate political communication. Louis is shown with bare legs and wearing a short military cloak called the sagum. In the Roman tradition, this signaled the Miles Romanus, the archetype of the virtuous Roman soldier.
Right.
But because the surrounding palm identifies him as the Miles Christie, that visual cue immediately transitions the viewer from seeing a traditional earthly warrior to recognizing him as the ultimate soldier of Christ, a figure who embodies both ancient Roman virtue and Christian spiritual duty.
This portrait, then, is the ultimate statement on the fundamental question the Carolingian world was wrestling with in the early 800s. What grants a king true legitimacy? Is it blood? Is it conquest? Or is it something else entirely?
And the image provides a powerful intellectual answer. It argues that lasting legitimacy is found at the intersection of God plus literacy plus theology. It required being chosen, understanding the divine word, and embodying piety.
A complete departure from the old Frankish model, where simple descent and victory on the battlefield were enough.
Completely. This put the intellectual, the scribe, the scholar, the theologian right at the very heart of imperial power.
Louis himself, he was personally consumed by this ideal of the monk king.
Yeah.
He really tried to live up to the standard this portrait set for him.
He did, and it defined his reign, often to his own political detriment. He was the first emperor truly committed to ruling as a man of profound spiritual discipline. In 822, he staged the famous public repentance at Adani, which scholars now call Imperial Confession Theater.
He publicly admitted his sins.
Yes, including the harsh treatment of a relative, and performed rites of penitence right there in front of a council of bishops.
What was the political effect of that kind of public penance?
It was incredibly risky, but also strategically necessary for him. By publicly repenting, he reinforced the idea that he, the emperor, was subject to divine and moral law. It demonstrated his piety and, in a way, purified his rule. It gave him immense moral authority with the clergy.
Which he needed.
But it also exposed him to political rivals who just saw it as weakness. He was so dedicated to this theologically pure model of ruling that he was forced to resign twice after internal rebellions.
And twice.
Only to be reinstated after the clergy intervened to support his divine mandate. The source tells us he paid a heavy personal price for living up to this ideal.
And the monastic scribes, who valued the word above all else, they paid him back in kind. They built him this magnificent, dense portrait, where the empire itself becomes a text, a shield made of Latin.
It's the ultimate convergence. The political reality Louis's need for theological justification is perfectly met by the intellectual tools of the scribes. They literally constructed a body of text around him, echoing that old monastic joke that letters were armor and the word shields the realm.
Louis the Pious is forever encased, protected, and legitimized by the written word. So what does this all mean? We've taken this tiny, intellectually rigorous piece of medieval propaganda and I think really uncovered its brilliance. It wasn't enough for Louis the Pious to just be a powerful military leader. He had to be a king of the word. This visual poetry, the Carmina Figurata, was a sophisticated tool to make the profound statement that the emperor's power derived from divine authority, critical thinking, and literacy, not just military might or inheritance.
And the legacy of this deep dive is really understanding how power is constructed through intellectual means. In the 9th century, the highest form of political legitimacy required the emperor to be shielded and defined by theological text. So it raises an important question for you to mull over. If the Carolingian Empire itself became a text, what are the implications for modern rulers? Their images, their legitimacy are built not on dense theological manuscripts, but on fragmented, constantly changing digital streams and media narratives. What is the subtle, often hidden text that grants modern legitimacy, and what is the architecture of that power today? That's worth exploring.